very nice to see many familiar faces. And know that people have been practicing the Dharma over a long period of time, and that you continue your practice, not just do it a little while and then get tired and do something else. Okay? Because that continuity in our practice is really, really important. So I think last time I was here, I can't remember exactly, but I think last time I spoke on Buddhism, one teacher, many traditions. Yeah? And so that book was written by His Holiness Dalai Lama, and I helped. And it was talking about the basic Buddhist practices and beliefs from the viewpoint of the Pali tradition and the viewpoint of the Sanskrit tradition. And so really seeing how much similarity there is in beliefs and practices, and then also noticing the special features of each tradition. And then I think the time before that I was here, again I can't remember, there may be some other times in between, I was here with Dr. Russell Colt. He's a psychologist. And we spoke on a book that we co-authored called Living with an Open Heart, which is also on the book table. Did any of you come to that? Not here. No, it was here. I remember. I sat here and he sat there. And we looked out this way.
Yeah,
yeah.
That was a Sunday service.
Yeah, it was a Sunday course. And it was really fun because, you know, he's a psychologist, I'm a Buddhist nun, and we were both talking about how to develop compassion and what compassion is, what it isn't, and why it's important in our life, just, you know, to have a happy life now, and why it's important in our spiritual practice. So this time, we're going to talk about another book, not the whole book. This one's a little bit big to talk about in one evening. But we're going to talk about one section in the book on the four establishments of mindfulness. So this is a practice done in the Pali tradition, also in the Sanskrit tradition. At Srivasti Abbey, where I live, we've done this practice in retreat situations when we do our winter retreat. And most of us really love this practice. Am I right? Yeah. Wake up, you have to nod your head. So, yeah. So this is another book by His Holiness that I collaborated with him on. And so in talking about the four establishments of mindfulness, we talked about it pretty much. We mixed the teachings from the two traditions together because they were so similar. Yeah, in certain aspects, so we had to talk about them a little, you know, first one there, the other, but in most of them we put them together at the same time. So I want to start, before getting into the actual four, I want to talk a little bit about the purpose of the practice and how these four establishments or foundations of mindfulness, how they're related to the four truths, okay, how they're related to the four distorted conceptions. Okay? So, when I was working on this book, I just kept writing, and then at the end realized that it's pretty thick. Yeah? And so, we decided with the publisher that the future volumes would be thinner first of all, in the Sanskrit tradition, you know, they ask, well, why do we meditate on these particular four objects? The body, yeah, feelings, mind, and phenomena. Okay, so why do we meditate on those? And there's four distorted conceptions, or four conceptual errors, I should say, that we have regarding the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. Okay? So the first one is that we think that the body is the residence of the self, or it's the place where the self resides. I am here inside my body. Do you feel that way? Yeah? So all of this is getting us to look at how we conceive of the self. And then, of course, we're going to see if how we conceive of the self is accurate or not. Okay? Hint, it isn't accurate. But, you know, when we just look at our basic feeling, we feel like I am here, right? I'm inside this body. Yeah, I'm not over there. I'm not up there. I'm here. Okay? So that's one reason why the body is an object of our mindfulness. Yeah. How does the body relate to the self? Is the self inside the body? Like we feel it is. Then with feelings, we conceive that the feelings are what the self enjoys or what the self experiences. Okay, I feel happy, I feel miserable, yeah, I feel nothing, indifferent. Okay? So we experience all these feelings all day long, and here we're just talking about pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings, or happy, painful, and indifferent feelings. And it's just different words for the same meaning. And we feel all these feelings, and the feelings, our responses to these feelings generate, you know, we respond to these feelings with attachment, with aversion, with apathy, okay? And so our feelings really control a lot of our lives, or I should say that our responses or reactions to feelings of happiness, pain, and indifference could, you know, really control our lives. And again, it's I who experience these things. Don't you feel that way? I am happy. I am miserable. I don't feel anything. Okay? So the feelings are related to the I, too. And the third one, the mind. So we tend to conceive that our mind, our consciousness, is the I, is the self. I am my mind, okay? I am what thinks and perceives. I am what cognizes. Okay, do you feel that? Yeah, when you say I, yeah, I think. And we really identify with our mind as being who we are. Okay, so again, there's the self mixed in with the mind somehow. And we think that we are our mind. And that makes sense, you know, because what's the difference between a live body and a corpse? It's the presence or absence of the mind. So we say it's the presence or absence of the person. And the fourth one, phenomena. And here phenomena means various mental factors, okay? So the mental factors include different emotions, different discriminations, all sorts of different aspects of the mind that create cognition, okay? So you know, we conceive of phenomena, in particular these mental factors, as what makes the self afflictive or beholden. Okay? So, for example, we think, I have so many problems with jealousy. So jealousy is a mental factor. Yeah. And then, does jealousy make us afflictive or make us wholesome? It makes us afflictive, doesn't it? Yeah. So, or we say, oh, I have, you know, incredible faith in the three jewels. So faith makes us virtuous. So we look at phenomena, all these different mental factors, different attitudes and emotions that we experience, as what makes the self, the person, either something virtuous or, you know, non-virtuous. Okay? So this is why we focus on these four, because they're very intricately related to how we conceive of ourselves. In particular, we conceive of ourselves in totally wrong ways. And that's why we pay attention to the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, because that will help us see our erroneous conceptions regarding the self. Because these erroneous graspings at the self, that's the root of our samsara, isn't it? Why do we circle from one lifetime to the next? It's because of ignorance. Yeah? And one facet of ignorance is just, this is from the Sanskrit tradition viewpoint, is just not knowing. And that's also how ignorance is defined in the Pali tradition. But in the Sanskrit tradition, ignorance isn't just not knowing, not just a fog or a cloud in the mind, but it actively misunderstands how we exist and how phenomena exist. Okay? So we always assume that what we think is correct. Try again. Yeah. If what we think is correct, we would not be in cyclic existence right now. We would be arhats. We would be Buddhas. Okay. Why are we still in cyclic existence? Because our mind is obscured by ignorance and attachment and anger and so on. And these emotions are based on many wrong conceptions. And some of the conceptions are so habitual, we're so used to them, that we don't even notice that we have them. Yeah, and that's the tricky part. Yeah, when we don't even notice how obscured our mind is, how confused our mind is. Yeah, and we think, oh, I'm bright, everything's good. I'm in control of my life. Yeah. How much are we in control of? We feel, oh, I'm in control of my life. I went to school, I got a job, I have a paycheck. I decide how to spend my paycheck. I'm in control here. Yeah. Can you keep your body from aging? Can you control that? When we sat in meditation, did you not? Is there anybody here who wasn't distracted? We can't control our body and mind. So this idea of, you know, well, there's a big me who's in control, is going to manage it all. That's, you know, hallucination on our part. Okay. So, the way the self is conceived in those four ways that I just mentioned, is erroneous because they all assume that there's an independent, very concrete I or self that's in control. And then our body, our feelings, our mind, all the mental factors, they're all arranged around that self, supporting that self. But in the center, me. Do you feel me? Most of the day, what are you aware of? Me. So, then there's another reason, too, why these four are selected as objects of mindfulness. Okay, and that is because it helps us to understand how destructive and constructive actions come about so that we can abandon our destructive actions and engage in constructive actions. Okay, so here's how these four relate to our actions. So the body is the chief object involved in our actions. Yeah? So a lot of our life centers around our body and making our body comfortable as I move the cushion and adjust my position. Okay? A lot, we center us so much. You know, get up in the morning, brush our teeth, yeah, put on clothes, you know, we eat. Everything centers around keeping this body alive. Why do you go to work? To get money, to buy food, clothes, shelter, and medicine, to keep this body alive. Yeah? Then we got to make this body good looking. We've got to try and do our best to prevent it from aging. You know, we've got to make it comfortable and happy. So we need to buy a bed that is just soft enough, but not too soft. And just hard enough, but not too hard. And then to get the food we like, which has just enough salt, but not too much. Yeah, and sugar, quite a lot. Yeah, never too much sugar. See, I'm thirsty. I have to drink, make the body comfortable. Okay, so the body is the chief object that our actions center around. Okay. And then feelings are the aim for which we do these actions. In other words, we seek to experience pleasant feelings and to avoid painful feelings. Okay? So, you know, the body is the center of the main object we act around. The feelings motivate us to act. We want happiness, we don't want suffering. And wouldn't you say that's the basic thing in your life all day long? Yeah, is how can I be happy, how can I avoid misery? Would you say that that's the basic thing in your life? When you look around, you know, everybody sitting here in this room who has a different life, different thoughts, different needs, but they all center around, how can I be happy? How can I be free of suffering? That's the basic thing, about all of us. If we remember that, then we can really relate to every sentient being because we know that very fundamental core of what makes them tick. They want happiness, they don't want suffering. Okay? So if you think of somebody that you don't like who drives you crazy, why are they doing that? They're trying to get happiness and avoid suffering. And they're just confused about how to do it. If you think of somebody you love dearly, what motivates them? They're trying. trying to be happy and avoid suffering. And often they go about getting happiness and avoiding suffering in a very confused way too, as do we. Okay, then the mind is the agent that causes our actions. Okay? Our actions don't just happen. Yeah. There is the mind, and especially one mental factor called intention. Okay? And that intention in our mind, you know, is what makes us act and what makes us think about certain things and plan certain things and do certain things. Okay? So the mind is also involved in our actions. And then the various mental factors such as attachment, animosity, jealousy, arrogance, and so on. They are the motivating factors for our actions. Yeah? So the mind has the intention to act. But what actually motivates us? Well, when there's attachment in my mind, yeah, that combines the attachment, generates the intention to do a certain object so that I can, a certain action, so that I can have pleasant feelings. When anger is in my mind, it combines with intention and motivates me to do an action to stop the harm or the suffering that I'm experiencing. Okay? So body, feelings, mind, and phenomena are all involved not only with the self, but also with our actions. And as we know, action means karma, and karma is what influences what we become and what we experience. Okay, so the karma we create is something to be very, very careful about. Okay. So this is all introductory material. Yeah. I'm not sure we'll have time even to get into the actual practice, but this introductory material is very important, and because it sets the basis for why are we doing this practice. Because if we don't know why we're doing the practice, then why are we doing it? Okay? If we don't know why we're doing it, then we don't know how to evaluate if we're reaching the correct conclusion when we practice something or whether we're reaching a wrong conclusion. Okay? So we have to understand these things. And for me, you know, I like this part because it really gets me to think about how I think of the self, the I. You know, because the I is the center of my world. Actually, I am the center of the universe. The problem with the universe is that it doesn't realize this. Okay. So I'm the most important thing around. And if all of you only listened to my advice, then everything would be great. Because I have good advice for all of you. Yeah. And the problem is, when I give you my good advice, you look at me like I'm nuts. And you say, mind your own business. And you ignore my advice. Unbelievable. Yeah? Because my advice is the best advice. Why? Because it's mine. And I would never believe anything that's wrong. So whatever I believe is right. Yeah, because I'm the center of the universe, I never believe anything wrong. And if what I believe is different tomorrow than what I believe today, then today this thing is right and tomorrow the other thing is right. Because the criteria for right is what I believe. Okay. Now, do you think the same way? Yeah? Do you run your life the same way? Yeah? With I as the center of your world, the most important thing that you look out for and take care of? Yeah. And the thing is, you think that there's so much suffering because the rest of us, including me, don't understand how wise you are. But I think we have so many problems in the world because you don't understand how wise I am. Okay? So, can you see why we have trouble in the world? Yeah? Can you see why there's discord and quarrels and wars? Because everybody's centering everything on their notion of I, assuming that their idea of what I is correct, and that such an I actually exists. This I that is here, I am here. And we believe in that I, and we do everything for it. And that's why we have so many problems. But when the Buddha comes along and says, check up, if the I really exists the way you think it does, we say, Buddha, come on. No, I feel I know I. Why should I ever doubt that I exists in the way that it appears to me? And Buddha kind of looks at us and goes, oh, another lost cause. Okay, so this is why after the Buddha attained an awakening, he didn't teach at the beginning because he thought nobody would understand it. And he's probably right. Yeah? Fortunately, there were a few beings with little dirt in their mind, you know, and so he was convinced to teach and he taught them and they responded. But if it was just people like me, alive at the Buddha's time, Buddha probably would not forget it. Yeah, these people don't want to think about anything except what they want and getting their way and winning arguments and blaming other people for all their trouble. That's all these worldly beings want. Fortunate for us, the Buddha has great compassion and he didn't give up on us. Yeah, that's why great compassion is so important on the path. If we don't have great compassion, then it's so easy to give up on other living beings and say, forget it. You know, you guys are hopeless. I'm going to get awakened and stay in my nirvana and good luck. Because I'm out of here and, you know, you're tied to samsara. I'm so glad the Buddha had great compassion and didn't think like that. But look how we are sometimes with other people. Yeah, we're so impatient and judgmental with them. That's why so many people in Dharma talks ask me for advice about how to change their relatives. They don't ask me for advice on how to practice the Dharma themselves and change themselves, because they assume they're already A-OK. But they ask me for advice, what do I do about my father, what do I do about my mother, what do I do about my boyfriend, my girlfriend, my brother, my sister, my son, my daughter, the teacher, the government. What do I do about all of these? President Trump. What do I do about this guy? Okay? So that's what we think about. We don't look at our own self and try and change what we can change and see if our own, ideas are correct. We just look at other people and go, these guys are nuts. Especially, maybe Singapore's a little bit calmer, and I don't know how much you're following in the U.S., but it's pretty crazy there. So this is why compassion is important, to have compassion for all these people who have power and have no wisdom. Who do not understand the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. Who do not understand who they are and who they aren't. Who basically are just like me, except I have the right to criticize them. Okay. So then, to continue on with some more of the introductory material, we have four distorted conceptions. Okay? So four distorted conceptions. One is we think that things that are impermanent by nature are permanent. Okay. We think that things that are dukkha by nature are happiness. We think that things that are impure and unclean are sparkling pure and clean. And we think that things that lack an essence or a self have a self. So those are four distorted conceptions. I'm sure you've, many of you have studied these. What's really interesting about those is when we hear about them in Dharma practice, they make sense and they seem correct. But when we live our life, we totally forget about them. Okay? Even the first one, anicca, impermanence. We all talk about impermanence, right? All phenomena, all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. Things come, they go, they come together, they separate. Nothing's steady, nothing's stable. Be ready for change. We live in the nature of change. What else is new? Right? You study about anicca. And you think like this. Then, what happens? Somebody spills spaghetti sauce on your new blanket and you freak out. Spaghetti sauce on my clean new blanket. It's gonna be dirty. You made it horrible. How can you do this? This is my precious blanket. Right? Maybe you some of you don't think about your blankets. Try your car. Okay. And not somebody spilling spaghetti sauce on your car, but somebody denting your car. You know? You park your car, you go do something, you come back in, out, and there's a dent. And you just look and say, oh, it's Anisha. Yeah, I knew it was coming. Everything's in change, everything's in flux, you know. So, no problem. There's a dent in my new car. Yeah. So, you know, it's so easy to talk about Anisha. Is it easy to live with an awareness of impermanence? You have a very close friend, okay? And you and your friend are just, you know, you're very fond of each other. Maybe you're even boyfriend and girlfriend, or maybe you're just regular friends, but you're just very close, okay? And you rely on your friend, and your friend relies on you, and you, you know, have talked about your friendship, and you want to be friends forever because you really like each other. Yeah? And you both talk about Anicca together because you're both Buddhists. You know, oh, everything's impermanent, things come and go, and we'll grow old together, we'll still be friends, and, you know, my hair will turn colors, and, you know, it's all impermanent, and there's no problem. And then, one day, your friend says, bye-bye, I don't want to be friends with you anymore. And you go, how can you do this? I thought that we were had some commitment, some trust with each other, yeah, that we were going to be together always. You know, and Nietzsche wasn't supposed to apply to us. It applies to the rest of the world. That changes. But what are you doing? Kind of dropping me as a friend without any warning. Yeah. So we've totally freaked out. Then we go back, we read our Dharma book. Oh yeah, there's three characteristics. Things are impermanent, things are by nature dukkha. There's no self, what else is new? Yeah. We don't realize why are we suffering so much when our car is dented and when our friend drops us. Why? Because we don't really believe in Anicca. We talk about it a lot. But inside of our hearts, no, this is supposed to last forever and not change. Why? Because I said so. Yeah, that's a good reason, isn't it? I said so. I think it should. So do you see why we suffer? Yeah? So often what we think is like not related to reality. Quite sad. Okay, so that was the first wrong conception. Yeah? You think things that are impermanent are permanent. We think that things that are polluted by nature are, that all, I'm reading the wrong list. Anyway, I know them. We think, yeah, when you try and read the list of what you already know, but you read the wrong list. Okay. So, you know, we think that things that are unclean and impure are pure. Right? Okay? So, what's in the toilet is impure. Yeah, the garbage out the lanes is impure. All these things are dirty. But my body's clean because I wash it all the time. Okay. But my body doesn't have the nature of being unclean, even though I have to wash it all the time because it always gets dirty. Okay? Is our way of thinking making sense? We look at other people's bodies and like, oh, wow, look at that body. You know? So good looking. But what's on the inside of his body? Yeah. Or what comes out of his body? Yeah, snot from here, vomit, bad breath from here, little crinkly things from the eyes, earwax from here, sweat from here. I won't mention what comes out of the lower organs. Okay. So actually, you know, what comes out of his body is filthy. And if I could mentally, you know, open up his body, what's inside? A stomach, a liver, a pancreas, a spleen, a big intestine, a little intestine, a bladder, two kidneys, an esophagus, a brain. Are any of those things gorgeous? If you took out, you know, this guy that you think is so good looking, you unzipped and took out all the parts of his body and you laid them all out here. Okay, two eyeballs there, two ears over there, a tongue over here. Yeah, all the skin over here, you know, hair, you know, all the hair over here, and the liver, and, you know, all these internal organs, and, you know, the bones kind of scattered around, and the muscles and the tendons, and all this kind of stuff. Does he look so good looking then? Yeah? That guy that you thought was like, wow. Do you even want to look at the inside of his body? What about our own body? That, you know, I dyed my hair. Yeah, I grew it the length that I like it. Everybody thinks my hair is so nice. I work really hard to make my body attractive. What is my body really? The inside of it is pretty much the same as that guy's body. You know, maybe his big intestine is a couple of inches longer than mine. Maybe not. Okay. But we think our body is beautiful and attractive. We think other people's bodies are beautiful and attractive. Well, not everybody's. When they're young, they're beautiful and attractive. When they get old, they change. And yet, what really are our bodies? Are they so pure? Are they so beautiful? Yeah, they're kind of basically a bunch of vegetable goo. Yeah? They're recycled broccoli, recycled salad. If you eat meat, it's somebody else's body recycled. Okay. So that's another misconception we have. We're pretty blind to it. How do we know we're blind? Because whenever I talk about this, the last thing people want to hear. I was asked to speak at a Buddhist college in America to Dharma students, to people who had studied the Dharma for a while. And I was speaking on these four conceptions. Oh boy, people did not like my Dharma talk. They were putting up so many objections. How can you say the body's impure? How can you say this? How can you say that? You know, our body's the basis of our precious human life. It's to be treasured, and it is beautiful. Look at all the artists. Look at what Michelangelo did. You know, he thought the human body was so gorgeous, and he carved David, and, you know, I mean, David's a great sculpture, if you... You know, I mean, you have to admire Michelangelo's skill, but, you know, I mean, at least David's body doesn't exude all the things alive on it. But, you know, people love the body and they do artwork around it. Now, how can you say it's filthy? These were people who were Buddhists. So I suspect some of you are thinking the same thing. Yeah? So, if you don't like the teaching, talk to the Buddha about it. Because I'm just repeating what the Buddha said. And if you don't agree and you don't like it, you go discuss with Buddha. Okay? And maybe the Buddha will quell your doubts and you'll begin to understand why the body is not so clean and pure. Okay, then we think that things, so that's the second one, you know, we think impermanent things are permanent, unclean things are clean. The third distorted conception is we think that things that are by nature unsatisfactory, or dukkha, are pleasant and happy and wonderful. Okay? So, what did Buddha say about samsara? Okay? Everywhere he talked about the disadvantages of samsara, all the bad qualities of samsara, because we need to be aware of those so that we can aspire for liberation. Okay, right? Hello? Yeah, Buddha talks about, you know, the disadvantages of samsara. Do you remember the story about the leper, when he talked about the leper? Yeah, I forget which sutta it was in. But he talks about a leper, you know, when people have leprosy, their limbs are quite itchy and painful. And one way that they calm the pain from the disease is they scorch their limbs. They burn them. Yeah? They don't feel pain from burning it. It remedies the itchiness. But in the process, they're harming their own body. This is what the disease of leprosy does. Okay? So he says, Buddha said, you know, in samsara, we're like that. We're so attached to samsara. And we're itching for more pleasure, and we don't like pain. Yeah? But everything we do to get pleasure and avoid pain is like a leper that is scorching their limbs to alleviate the itchiness and pain they experience. It only destroys you and creates more pain. Yeah. Another example is drinking salt water. You're thirsty, you crave water, you don't have any water handy, fresh water, so you drink salt water. At first it's like, oh good, I got some liquid in me. Then what happens? You feel greater thirst because you've drunk salt water. So this is like us in samsara. You know, we're dissatisfied, we go about running around trying to get everything we want, and we often create a lot of problems for ourselves in the process of it. Okay, so that's a problem. Yeah. And also, I mean, we think that all the things in samsara which are actually unsatisfactory, we think they're marvelous. You know, your new car, that one before it got dented, is marvelous. It brings you so much happiness. Yeah? Until it doesn't. Because as soon as you have a car, then you are exposed to car hell. Okay? Car hell is when you're in a hurry to get somewhere, you get in your car, and it doesn't start. Okay, car hell is, you know, when you're driving along the highway to go do something fun and you get a flat tire. Car hell is when somebody rear-ends you or you rear-end somebody else. Okay, car hell is when you get your insurance bill. Okay? But we think the car is the cause of happiness. It's the same with digital things. You know how people are so addicted to digital things now? Yeah. Which is worse, car hell or computer hell? or phone hell? I don't have a phone, but you know, I imagine all of you do. Yeah. What happens? You turn on your phone, you turn on your computer. I was meditating on emptiness. Why are you empty? You know? You ever done that? You turn on your computer and it's like nothing comes up. I've had that happen. And it always happens when you're in a hurry and you need to get some information off. Always, okay? So the things that we chase after, that we run after, we think are so wonderful, are also the source of a lot of our anxiety, our frustration, our inconvenience. Okay, this is the nature of samsara. Then, as I adjust my body to get comfortable again for the next 15 seconds, then the other wrong conception is we think that things that don't have a self or some kind of findable essence do. Okay? So we think that there's a big me here. But when we start to investigate and try and find exactly who is the I, yeah, it becomes very difficult to point to something that is us. Yeah. This one is the hardest one to understand, okay? Because we feel so strongly that there's me. But when we try and find out what really does the word me or I refer to, what are you going to point to as being who you are? Yeah. Is your body you? Is your mind you? Is your ID card you? We have our passports and our ID card. Who's the person that they refer to? Okay? Well, that's another wrong conception we have. These four wrong conceptions also correlate with the four objects of our mindfulness. Okay? So, holding something that is foul and impure as pure, which one of the four do you think that applies to? The body. Yeah? Okay. Holding what is unsatisfactory in nature as marvelous and the source of happiness and delight, that correlates with feelings. Okay? We think our happy feelings are just over the moon. But how long do our happy feelings last? Okay. Holding what is momentary as permanent, that's the mind. Correlates with the mind, the wrong conception of the mind. And holding what doesn't have a self as having one, that's pertains to the mental factors. So you see all these different correlations. Yeah. Another correlation is the body, yeah, correlates, of the four truths, the body correlates with true dukkha. Feelings correlates with true cause. The mind correlates with true cessation. And phenomena correlates with true path. Yeah. So when you're doing this practice of the four establishments of mindfulness, you know, then it's really good to understand this introductory material and see these different correlations between conceptions, you know, wrong views, distorted views, the truth, you know, of the four truths, and to see how these correlations fit together. And if we do that, then when we start really examining closely the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, it becomes much more alive, and we really kind of get something out of the meditation. Because we know that we're trying to overcome four wrong conceptions. Okay? So we really work on that. We know we're trying to understand the four truths. Okay, with that, that's the introduction. Getting into the actual practice, I think we'll have to wait until next time I come. what I'd like to do now is open it. You probably have some questions or comments, and we can talk about them.
In relation to what you discussed today about the four established of mindfulness, can you talk a little bit about walking meditation and sitting meditation and how to do the practice of walking meditation?
Okay, so how to do walking meditation. Okay, there's many different kinds of walking meditations, different styles. The purpose of doing walking meditation, again, is to develop mindfulness and introspective awareness when our senses are functioning and when we're in the world, because, you know, we need this kind of mindfulness and introspection to monitor our mind. What are we thinking? What are we saying and doing? So that we can abandon the cause of suffering and practice the cause of happiness. So that's why we're doing the walking meditation. So there's different ways to do it according to the different traditions. And so I'll speak of a few of these. They probably aren't all of them, but will give you some idea. So one way is, and this is the way kind of prominent in the Theravada tradition, where you start out walking a little slower than normal, yeah, and you just become aware of right and left, okay? Then you slow down a little bit and you become more aware of lifting and placing, lifting and placing. Okay. Then you slow down even more and you become aware of lifting, pushing and placing, lifting, pushing and placing. And so that the idea is to become more focused on the more refined or subtler movements of the body. What's also very interesting to do when you're walking slowly like that is to be aware of how the 2 feet influence each other. Yeah? How they depend on each other. One foot cannot act on its own without the support of the other foot. And the two are constantly balancing and rebalancing each other. You can also contemplate impermanence when you're doing walking meditation, because each of the movements of your foot is changing all the time. So you're aware of change there. Okay? So that's one way to do walking meditation. In the Chan tradition, in both Japan and China, then they walk very quickly, and so they'll tend to have a Buddha in the center of the meditation hall. Meditation hall is circular, and people sit around the edge, often facing the wall to avoid distraction. And then to take breaks from the meditation, they stand up and they circumambulate the Buddha in the center. And so sometimes some people may walk very close to the Buddha. That's probably a slower walking. Another group will walk a little bit further away, make a bigger circle. They walk a little bit faster. And then there's another group on the outside that are speeding along. And they do this to energize the body, because when you're meditating, you need to get some exercise, you need to move your body. Okay, so that's another way to do it. Another way is just to walk normally. You know, sometimes when people do walking meditation, they walk from one point to the next, turn around and walk back. You know, other times you may just, you know, walk in the park or wherever. You don't necessarily have to turn around after so many feet and walk back. But this time, when you're walking, you contemplate who is walking. I say, I'm walking. Who is the I that is walking? Why do I say I'm walking? I say I'm walking because the body is walking. Is the body me? No, body's not me. So who is this I that is walking? And you investigate the nature of the self that way. Another way to do it is you walk and you think of the Buddha at your heart, or Kuan Yin at your heart, or on your head, facing the same way as you. And as you're walking, you think of the Buddha or Kuan Yin radiating light that's going out and touching all the living beings and calming their minds, bringing them joy, bringing them wisdom. So that's a nice thing to do when you're walking back and forth in an airplane. Oh, no, in an airport, waiting for the airplane to leave, and there's lots of sentient beings around, and you radiate, you know, love to them. several different ways for walking meditation. Other questions or comments?
May I just clarify, so the purpose of meditating on the four objects is to overcome the four erroneous conceptions and also to understand the four truths?
What's the last phase? To understand
the four truths.
The four truths, yes.
Then could you elaborate how does it correlate to the four truths?
Yeah, what I just said, the body.
No, I mean why does it relate in that way? Why does the body, how is the body related to true suffering?
Because our body is the basis on which we experience most of our pain and suffering. Don't you think?
Because my idea of suffering, because there's also suffering of conditionality, right, which doesn't have so much to do with the body.
Oh, it does. The example of conditionality, or are you saying the second suffering or the third?
The third.
The third. The third is all pervasive, okay? So that's applied to everything in samsara. So, you know, it applies to feelings and everything else. But here, you know, the first two kinds of dukkha really apply so much to the body. Yeah. Whenever they make correlations or analogies, it doesn't mean everything correlates or everything is analogous. Okay.
Venerable, I would like to ask, Buddhist wisdom is a series of juxtapositions. So you have, for example, I exist and I don't. So basically, conventionally you exist and ultimately you do not. So I'd like to find out what are the practical things I can do to apprehend simultaneously both truths at one time.
Okay, they say only a Buddha understands both truths simultaneously.
Yes, fine.
Okay, so the best way to do that is to become a Buddha. Okay? So on the path to Buddhahood, yeah, one thing to do is you can focus on the conventional side and how things are dependent. And then as you're thinking about how they're dependent, then see that because they're dependent, they're also empty. And then you focus on the empty side for a while, and then you think, well, they're empty, but they're also dependent. So you go back and forth between the two, and then that helps you really understand, you know, to see that the two truths and that the two things, empty and dependent, are not contradictory.
How do you do that without being schizophrenic?
You spend some meditation sessions focusing a lot on dependence, you know, and get a good understanding of that, and then you use the reason of dependence to prove that to yourself that things are also empty of inherent existence. Okay, they're not empty of all existence. They are not non-existent, but phenomena are empty of a certain type of existence that has never existed. Okay? And so you use dependence to help you see that, you know, things have never existed as independent, isolated, self-enclosed phenomena that don't relate to anything else. That everything that exists is related to many, many other factors.
As a person who has been practicing for so many years, Venerable, what goes through your mind as you go through your day? Do you see conventional reality or do you actually see ultimate reality all the time? I'm sorry, it's a loaded question.
If I'm going to be truthful, I see sentient beings above me. I see annoying then I have to see my own bias and prejudice and aversion and so on. Okay? And then I start to see a little bit their kindness, their and have compassion. So I'm operating at a different level. I'm not on the level of, you know, seeing emptiness and dependent arising as complementary. Sorry. Okay. Talk to me in a few eons, maybe I'll
sticking to the three characteristics like anicchang and I mean maybe you but not we lay people anatta and dukkha. So sometimes I experience myself that when in living in the everyday life it's getting let's say there are a lot of things that can cause a lot of attraction, and I sometimes do not like as a practitioner to sometimes get towards my capabilities to be drawn into something, and sometimes I also get angry about myself if this happens. And I sometimes feel also, sometimes I'm more diligent in, for example, there are super techniques, I practice it also with females sometimes, I see, oh, it's or with me myself also, I see, have the unattractive things in myself. The question to you is, how would you apply this practice in everyday life? Would you just mind not go to such places that can cause a lot of attraction, or would you would you give a tip to overcome this? Because I'm married, I have a family, I have a daughter also, and we might attend every place, and I feel sometimes very very odd when people say they play piano, they say, oh, it's so beautiful, and it's like this, and I'm really not of this world sometimes, I feel like this. How would you apply this practice to this situation?
Okay, that's kind of a big question. Let's see if I can dent it a little bit. Where do you want me to start? So one of your questions was, you know, do we avoid things that we find attractive?
Yes.
Yeah? That is going to depend a lot on the person, okay? If you're very serious about practicing the Dharma, then, and if you have a very good understanding of yourself and you know what things you get so attracted to that make your mind get out of control, then you take some space from those things. Okay? Or if there's things that you know because of our own weakness we get attached, because of our own weakness we get angry, you know, and then we create negative karma. So to avoid creating the negative karma, we step back from those things. This is the purpose of many of our monastic precepts, you know, to keep us away from things that people usually get overwhelmed by. As you progress, you know, and you have more control over your mind so that attachment and anger and jealousy and arrogance don't arise so quickly and get so uncontrolled, then you can, you know, slowly start to enter those other situations if there's a reason to be there and go there. Yeah. If there's no reason to be there and go there, then you don't go there just for the heck of it.
But sometimes when I'm shifting back to this, for example, I'm contemplating the non permanency, and then sometimes I have maybe situations I'm feeling maybe weak inside myself, and I would like to stabilize this weakness by seeking also outer things, like for example having fun, like you mentioned it, having fun. So I just want to stress this point. I sometimes get then angry about myself and switching back and switching forward. And is you have something for
okay,
me?
Okay, yeah, we have to learn how to relax.
Yeah.
Yeah? And we tend to be very self-judgmental because we know a lot of information up here, but we can't practice it because we have so many old habits and not enough mindfulness and introspective awareness. So we can't expect ourselves to be perfect Dharma practitioners, especially when we're basically beginners. Now, you might think, well, I'm a beginner for a year, and then after that I should have it all down pretty well. The Buddha practiced three countless great eons. This was after he entered the path. Yeah? So, I don't know about you, but I'm nowhere near that point of actually entering the path. So it's going to take a while. So I do the best I can. Yeah? And I have, I stay away from the things that really make, you know, push my buttons and make my attachment so I'm going crazy. But I also, you know, we have to have fun, we have to relax, we have to talk to people, we have to sleep, we have to get exercise. At the beginning, you know, I don't know about you, but I had this idea, okay, I'm going to be like Milarepa. You know, Milarepa was this great Tibetan meditator who went off to the mountains. Yeah, he ate only nettles, so his body turned kind of green. He didn't wear very many clothes. He had long matted hair. And he attained awakening in that life. You know, so I thought, okay, I'm going to be this perfect Dharma practitioner and make my teacher so proud of me. Yeah, because I am watching all my eight worldly concerns and abandoning them completely. Except for you know? And then what I had to learn is we have to accept ourselves for where we're at right now. You know? Because if we get angry at ourselves and self-critical and judge ourselves and go, oh, you're such a lousy practitioner, that becomes an obstacle to practice. Yeah? I once met a young monk. He came and he wanted some advice, and he was telling me that he would think of the Buddha and that the Buddha would be looking at him and saying, you should be doing this and you should be doing that. And, you know, I taught you this, you should practice this. And that the Buddha was always scolding him. You're such a bad monk. You know? You took precepts and you're not keeping them properly and you don't have enough mindfulness and your mind's out of control. And this monk, this young monk, when he was explaining this to me, I could sense he was just like, you know, totally tied up in knots, you know, hating himself because he had this image of who he should be that was way up here and who he was here, you know, and he was mad at himself and I just had to keep saying to himself, it's okay, you know, you do what you're able to do. None of us can do what we're unable to do. So we do what we're able to do, and that's good enough. And if we do what we're able to do, gradually we'll be able to do more. So we just have to accept ourselves. And another thing that's important is we have to laugh at ourselves. that if we take ourselves so seriously, you know, oh, I sat down to breakfast and I have such attachment for these noodles. You know? Oh, I can't eat breakfast this morning because too much attachment. So, okay, I throw the noodles out. I'm going to go to work on an empty stomach. You know, look how renounced I am. It's like when we watch our mind get like that, we have to laugh at how ridiculous we are. You know, it's very important to laugh at ourselves and to laugh at our afflictions. Instead of going, oh, I'm such a horrible practitioner. You know? Because that doesn't do any good at all. Yeah. Okay? So you got to practice smiling. Seriously, you have to practice smiling and laughing and acceptance.
Thank you, Honorable. It's very enlightening talk and very thought provoking as well at the same time. On a note of introspection, I totally resonate with it, and I felt like to do it, you need a safe space to go deep inside and to do the inner work and stuff like that. And sometimes it means staying away from family because family can be such a trigger, right? But then sometimes family, they don't understand why you need that space. And then you know, it's about the same thing, like beating yourself up again, and it's like, okay, you know, I'm not failure, I'm not spending enough time with family, and my parents, and, you know, siblings, and extended families, you know.
Okay, best solution? Ordain. Because as long as you're a lay person, you're going to have that problem.
Yeah, so is there like a meter pop?
Okay, you divide down here. This half goes to see your family, and this half gets ordained.
But in the Theravada tradition, there are some texts about lay persons getting enlightened.
Yes, lay people can get enlightened. Yeah. I ordained because I knew as a lay person I would not get enlightened. Yeah. Okay, this will be the last question.
Okay, so my question is like, what kind of advice would you give to lay people? It's a similar question. Like in a society in Singapore where the workaholic culture is glorified, like, for example, how does one become a Buddhist and also like a workaholic?
Singaporean who was totally crazy. Yeah, well, maybe half crazy. Yeah. You have to set your own limits and you have to choose your priorities. If you want to be rich and famous and upper class and also have a good solid Dharma practice, that's going to be hard. Okay? So, I'm just talking generally. Different people are different, okay? So this is just a very general thing. But for most of us, you know, if we value our Buddhist practice and we want to learn how to calm our mind and to open our heart and develop compassion, then we need to give up, you know, staying out late at night, going to movies and hanging out with friends. Not all the time, but much less than we do now. if you really want to go deep in your practice, you have to renounce this thing that has become part of your body, that your whole life is involved in. Even when you're walking across the street, you know, and the cars are dodging you because you're oblivious. Yeah. You have to set limits on yourself and decide what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. Okay? And then, not everybody's going, your family and friends will not agree with whatever you decide. But even if you don't decide that, you decide something else, they won't agree with that either. Why? Because making other sentient beings happy is impossible. Pleasing other sentient beings is impossible. Okay? So you want to make everybody in your life happy, you can do 10 backflips, you know, and they're still going to want, you know, another backflip, or a cartwheel, or something. You know, sentient beings are never satisfied. If you live your life according to what other people want you to do, you're not going to have much of a life. Because you're going to be running around all the time, what does my mother want me to do? What does my father want me to do? What does my husband want me to do? What does my wife want me to do? What does this one want me to do? What does this one want me to do? You don't even know who you are anymore or what you want. So you have to start and, like, say, what is important in my life? Yeah, that's the thing that where you start. What is important in my life? When I die and look back on my life, what will I be happy about having done, and what will I be unhappy about having done? And think about that now so that you can make good choices and not do the things that you're going to feel bad about later, and do the things that you're going to feel good about later. Yeah? But trying to please everybody else in your life, impossible. Really. Anybody here feel like everybody in your life is happy with who you are and what you do? Anybody here feel like, you know, everybody you know is happy with who you are and what you do and what you have? No! Yeah? Can you think of one person who you're happy with who they are and what they have and what they do? No, you only have some advice for them. No? So we see, you know, trying to get like this, this samsara makes this impossible, you know? It's not going to happen. Okay? So that's why, you know, at the beginning of our Dharma practice, that's why the Buddha talked about our precious human life and the value and importance of it. And that's why he talked about death and impermanence, that we have this wonderful opportunity to meet the Dharma and practice it. And it's not going to last forever. So we better think about what's important and what's not important, and then live according to our own values and principles. And if you look at the Buddha's life, that's what he showed in his life, didn't he? Yeah? His father wanted him to stay in the community and, you know, take over the kingship and do the whole thing. And, you know, they all wanted him to have more kids and do this and that. And Buddha said, look, you know, there's a greater meaning to life than all of this stuff. And so he followed that. Okay. So I think that's a good point to close. And, you know, to really ask you to think about that quite deeply. Yes. So, do you have a chant that you'd like to do? Otherwise, we can put another slide on.
Due to this merit, may we salute.